And the hills of Bonshore did look pretty lovely tonight, coming here with the evening light on the trees across the hills. Very beautiful place to be. I was just remembering when I was in Russia, when we first went to Russia, and we were in this little village called Marianovka. And for the first year, I was just living there, getting used to Russian culture and the culture of the Russian Baptist Church and learning Russian. And even though I didn't speak a lot at that time in the church, because we were missionaries, we would be asked to speak. I can't imagine what I actually said, thinking back, and how little I knew of the language. But unlike here, where Jacques calls you up, you know, about 3 months in advance to warn you, you don't know if you're speaking until the meeting has started. So the minister will come down and walk up to you, as if I would come down now and walk up to you and say, "Would you preach, please?" And there's usually three preachers for each service, and the service is usually about 2 hours, 2.5 hours. So you have to be prepared every time. And sometimes I just wasn't prepared. But I found the key, and that was I wouldn't be asked if I wasn't wearing a jacket, a suit jacket. And so if I didn't have prepared, I just wore the shirt. And now they did, in that church, they didn't wear ties, but you had to do your top button up. That was the way to do it. But if you're a speaker, you really had to wear a jacket. So if I was not prepared, I didn't. But I'm wearing a sweatshirt, and I'm feeling quite patriotic because I'm going to become Canadian this week. So, because Jessica was wondering at my choice of attire for this evening. In fact, Toby has a jacket and white shirt. Maybe he should be preaching instead of me. But so the next time you see you, I won't be that funny little English man. I'll be the funny little Canadian. So this Friday in Stratford Town Hall at 8:30 sharp, I'll be saying the Canadian Oath, as it's called. So that's kind of an exciting day. My students gave me this sweatshirt at study abroad, so. We did bring a song today, but maybe we were thinking to sing it at the end, if that's okay. We'll see how the time goes. If you would like to turn to the Bible, to Romans chapter 12. And we're particularly going to focus, we're just going to do a little, a few thoughts from the chapter, but particularly the first verse and the last verse of Romans chapter 12, but also read through the chapter and get the whole feel of the chapter as well, I hope. And one thing, having looked through Romans recently, the thing that's really struck me, because I always, so much of what I've heard from Romans has been in the first 8 chapters, maybe the first 11 chapters, and in my mind, that has been really the great purpose of Paul to explain the gospel in its many facets. And you've studied it as a church, I'm sure, and you can spend a lot of time going through those first chapters. And it has been wonderful to do that. And then I sort of think, well, there's some practical teaching at the end, sort of a feeling. But the real meat of the message is the first chapters, and indeed they are very meaty. But in reading it through again and coming to the practical part of the epistle, you really get the feeling, or it has been apparent to me, and it seems more and more so, that this is what Paul is really getting at. Everything else is a foundation for the last chapters of the book. And if the chapters stopped at chapter 11, it would be, he wouldn't have said what he really wanted to say. Get to the main point, as it were, even though there's so much to treasure in those first chapters, and I do not want to put them any lower than they should be at all, but he had a purpose beyond those chapters, and we come to that purpose in Romans chapter 12. And at home, I've just been doing a project in the bathroom, remodeling the bathroom, and a while ago, I went out and finally, after looking in all the different places in Charlottetown, picked the tiles that I wanted for the surrounding the bath for the shower. We have not had a shower in our house for the 4 years that we've lived there. We've just had a bath, so we were really looking forward to having a shower. And I've spent a while choosing the tiles and getting all the grout and figuring out, watching the YouTube videos, how to do it and all that. And there were those tiles sitting there for weeks while I got other things came up, and I just couldn't find time. They were just sitting there collecting dust, and I'd had it all ready. I had all the knowledge of how to do it. I had all the materials for how to do it. But those tiles and everything sitting there were absolutely pointless, right? I mean, they don't do me any good. They just take up space, and that's it. Not doing good to anyone until I actually got down, put the stuff on the wall and put the tiles up and did the grouting. And you know, when you put the grout in, you've got to wipe them over a million times to get all that film off. And finally, you get to enjoy the blessing of actually taking a shower in our new shower and just be showered with blessing there. And this is kind of what we're looking at as we get to Romans 12. You can learn all about the first chapters and go so deeply and wonderfully into it and have all the knowledge and have all the tools and have it all figured out, the gospel, and you can explain the gospel and understand it, what Paul is saying. But if we don't get to Romans 12, it's all pointless in a sense that it doesn't actually do anything. It's only as valuable as it actually produces something in our life. And of course, that's what he wants to see in the church in Rome, and the Lord wants to see in our lives. And so we look at Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And we feel Paul's beseeching. I beseech you. And he says, I beseech you, therefore, and the most powerful therefore that there is in the Bible. It just carries all the weight to those first 11 chapters on the basis of this, therefore. And he tells us what it is. The mercies of God. And if somebody were to ask you, what do you really live for? What motivates you? What do you think of when you first get up in the morning? What is your motto? What is your thing that drives you? The first thing that sprung to your mind would be the mercies of God. Because it says, by the mercies of God, present your bodies. By the mercies of God, we act. We live. It's only by presenting our bodies to God that we can live for God. And think of that in your life. And what does that mean? The motivating force behind my life is the mercies of God. And a lot of Christians quote Richard Dawkins as their favorite atheist, but I will do it as well. Because recently he was in a bit of a hot water because on his Twitter account, somebody said, I honestly don't know what I would do if I were pregnant with a child with Down syndrome. A real ethical dilemma, someone was asking him. And he simply said, abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice. And one thing I like about Richard Dawkins, he is true to his belief. Because that is, if you like, the right response to his belief system. That is dictated by his belief system that we are basically animals, and it's unkind to bring someone with a disability into the world. There's no ethical dilemma. You kill it and you try again. And that is where his worldview takes him, and he lives according to that worldview. His advice is according to that view. What he says to other people is according to his belief system. And he acts upon it, and he would act upon it to kill a baby. So he's being very rational in the sense of according to his faith. I say that just to think about us. Do we live according to what we actually believe? And that is what our call is in this verse, to do that. What is the foundational point of your life that guides your actions? And for many people, there are many things that drive the way they live. Money, food, your past failures may dictate whether you do something or not. The lack of love that you've had in the past may dictate whether or not you love others. Your children may dictate how you live. Your retirement plan may dictate how you live. Being in pain may dictate how you live. Religion can dictate how you live. And so your looks, how people view you, can dictate how you live. But we are called to live by the mercies of God. By the mercies of God. And I'd just like to go back to Romans to find out what that actually means. If we go back to Romans 5, verse 6 through 8, we get a little taste of what that means. What are the mercies of God? And therefore, how do we live by them? And he says, Romans 5, 6 through 8, "For when we were yet without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die. But God commended his love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." So in that we get a little description of the mercy of God in his compassion for the weak. That's mercy. But also forgiveness for the sinner. Those are really the two sides of mercy. Compassion for the weak that we see in these verses, and forgiveness for the sinner. And so all of those chapters that build up to chapter 12, they really expound on that mercy and what God has done for us. And you put that all together, and that is the foundation and underpins the way we should live. Compassion and forgiveness. It's on that basis, give your life to God as an act of worship, an act of service to God. And that's what we're called to do in Romans 12. I'm not going to go into any more detail in that verse, though we could spend a lot of time. But by the mercies of God, give your life to him. So I just want to read the rest of the chapter. And first, though, go to the last verse of the chapter, which is verse 21, Romans 12, 21. It ends with a simple verse. "Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good." Be not overcome evil, but overcome evil with good. And that's really what I want to head to in the last little bit here. So we'll read the chapter so that we get the context flowing up to that verse. And I want you to think about, as we read, what verses in this chapter, chapter 12, actually help us to understand the last verse. Verse 21. So as we go through it, which verses do you think kind of shed some light on what that might mean for us? So let's read verse 2 down. "And be not conformed to this world, But be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may be able to prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And then jump down to verse 9. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another, with brotherly love, in honor, preferring one another. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer, distributing to the necessity of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless them which persecute you. Bless and curse not. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in doing so thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And when you have that first verse, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. The rest of the chapter really tells us what that looks like. What does it really look like to give your life to the Lord? And some of the things we've read, it's sort of a list that we've just gone through, but he's showing us what that is, a picture, a portrait of doing that, of giving your life to the Lord, and what it would look like in your life. And as we look at verse 21, did you notice any verses that kind of were connected with that and kind of led up to that? Because I think verse 21 is a bit of a culmination of what's been said before, and it's helpful to see the other verses that are something to do with that. I wrote down verse 2 in the sense of being conformed to this world. In other words, when we conform to the world, we do the opposite to verse 21. That's what the world does. The world does not repay, overcome evil with good. The world says the opposite, right? I think the number one movie in Charlottetown maybe right now for the last couple of weeks, The Equalizer, okay? That's what we're all about, isn't it? That's what it's all about, getting even. Getting even, that's the world, conformity to the world. You kick me, I kick you. Yeah, or whatever it is, I get you back. And that's the conformity to the world. But the Lord has something completely different for us, completely different. And then I thought, well, verse 9 is very connected to verse 21. Let love be without dissimulation. And it says, abhor that which is evil, cling to that which is good. So it's another verse that has good and evil in it. Hate evil. You're supposed to love what's good, hate what is evil. There's a love and a hate. It's a very strong verse, very connected with verse 21. And then verse 14 says, bless them which persecute you. Bless and curse not. You notice a little progression as we go through the last few verses. Here it says, don't curse. When someone does something evil to you, something bad, something nasty, something you don't like, our first reaction is to curse. Curse them, or curse just a, those stupid, like we wouldn't actually say it, but maybe out loud, but it's going on in here, right? That's our number first reaction when somebody does something, is to basically rain down cursing upon them by our words of hate. So it starts with words. And then it's verse 17. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Kind of the second thing we want to do is to get even. To actually do something that we will get even. We want justice in our minds, and we want to take justice into our own hands and set it right and do something equally nasty back. It's so basic that you see people, don't you, even when they bang their hand on something, they go, oh, don't they? They actually hit inanimate objects to try and get even with them and hurt themselves even more. People do that. Why do we do that? It's so natural to us to want to get even that we will even hit inanimate objects. Like, what foolishness, but we do it. So we curse, we try to get even, and then it also says in verse 19, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves. So not only do we want to get even, we want actual revenge, and revenge suggests a lust of hate, a pleasurable thing. We want to do more than what they did to us, because we want the pleasure of seeing somebody suffer. So we want to curse them, we want to get even, and we want revenge and more. We actually have a lust to see them suffer. But in all those things, it says, don't bless them that curse you. Don't give anyone evil for evil. And verse 19, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. So those are some verses that kind of set the tone for this last verse, verse 21. And let's just look at the implications of this verse and what it means, verse 21. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I guess the most basic thing to say about it is there is such a thing as good and evil. If you walk two blocks from here or wherever to the university, you will hear I had a quote here somewhere. Perhaps I have a quote. Yes. This is the Mr. Murray, Professor Murray at UPI. Because this verse says, overcome, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. If you want to study philosophy at UPI, you'll be told, morality is an evolutionary trait. It is useful to the extent that it enables us as social creatures to live together in peace. But it is not something out there in the world that we discover. It is not innate. It is something like a sense of humor we develop and value. The concept of morality as an objective fact is in the world is a myth. So that would be at odds with the Bible that says there is a right and wrong and a good and evil, and that is absolute. And that is a great debate among people, isn't it? But the Word of God is pretty straight on it. There is an evil and it is a good, as we see according to this verse. So what is good? Good is pleasant, something pleasant, agreeable, excellent, distinguished, perfect, upright, honorable, something useful, goodness. evil is such as it ought not to be. Base, wrong, wicked, troublesome, injurious, destructive, intrinsically worthless, depraved. The third verse, third word to look at, I suppose, is overcome. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. To overcome something is to subdue it, to conquer it, to prevail over it, to get the victory. So that's just kind of looking at the words, and then maybe look at the implication, another implication, which is it is possible to be overcome by evil. That would be the... So the first thing is good and evil exists. The second thing is it's possible to be overcome by evil. Do you recognize that? Because it must be, if you can overcome evil, you can also be overcome by it, right? What do you think that means, to be overcome by evil? How does that look? As soon as you do curse, as soon as you do seek revenge, as soon as you do seek all those things and go, you have been overcome by evil. You have allowed evil to be your master. And we see that in the cursing and the way we retaliate. We are immediately overcome. That's one aspect of being overcome by evil. But it's a powerful thing to see that evil is a powerful thing and we can be overcome by it. It is so naturally human to be evil. It is what we were born as unbelievers. We were born sinful. It is human and natural to be possessive and self-centered and unkind to people when they intrude on our space. It is human and natural in our fleshly state not to care about other people, but really only to seek our own good. It is human and natural, it comes very naturally in our flesh, to get mad at people who are mean to you. And it's very human and natural to treat people very differently according to how they treat you. It is so natural when somebody hurts you to want to hurt them back, to want to avenge them. And when your enemy is starving, as it were, you're happy. That is so human and so natural and part of our fallen condition. And that part of our natural state is that we, as fallen creatures, part of the fall is that we take matters into our own hands. We became as gods, as it were, knowing good and evil. And so we take the responsibility to avenge on ourselves because we think we've become like God and we can put out the revenge. But our justice is so corrupt that it always turns to revenge. So when we allow evil to overcome us, we are allowing the wrong to make us be the same. But this is the wonderful news of this verse. This is the last thing. It's good and evil exists. It's possible to be overcome by evil. But it is possible as Christians to overcome evil. That's really the message of this verse. It is possible to overcome evil. And I suppose the first thing to say, and it's not by doing nothing. And perhaps one of those really famous quotes, isn't it? The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. And you've probably heard that quote before, right? But it sort of goes along with that verse. This verse is not a call just for passive resistance and doing nothing. It's to actually do something. Not by non-resistance, I should say, but by actually doing something. Doing nothing is not an option. If we do nothing, we will be overcome by evil. And it says, we overcome evil with good. With good. It's very simple. By active goodness. by doing good things when somebody or something or our enemy or at work, at school, whatever it is, when evil comes upon us, we respond with goodness. I mean, that is the gospel. This verse is the gospel in the sense that is what it is all about, is that Christ came and overcame evil with good. That is what being a Christian is. We are people who overcome evil with good. That is the foundational thing of the way we live, is that we do good. And that's how evil is overcome. And we look around the world and see the evil being against evil, and the war that is, the wars that are on right now. But it's a very powerful thing, and I'm going to read a quote which I think says it the best. This is a Spurgeon quote. And think about this. Think of the question, how does doing good in return for evil, how does it work? Why is it so powerful? Listen to this. The benefit of the method of returning good for evil is that it preserves the man from evil, preserves yourself from evil. If evil assails you and you only fight it with good, it cannot hurt you. You are invulnerable. If any man curses you, and you answer with a blessing, it is clear that he has not hurt you. He has not made you full of curses, or else one would come out of you. If a man has slandered you, but you never return him a reproachful word, he has not hurt your real character. The dirt which he has thrown has missed you, for you have none to throw back at him. If, when much provoked, your temper still remains calm and quiet, the provocation has not touched you. The arrow has passed harmlessly by. The very thing your enemy wants is to make you descend to his level of anger and malice. But as long as having much provocation you remain unprovoked, you vanquish him. It's a powerful thing. It's so powerful, and it can change the way we should be, the way we live, shouldn't it? And I just want to give a couple of examples from the Bible and a couple of examples from life. Just want to read to you in the last few minutes of how we see this, firstly in Jesus' own life, Christ's own life. 1 Peter 2, 22-24, speaking of the Lord, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. Not only did Christ not respond to what was being done to him and in revenge, but he also did good. He was taking their very sins upon himself. And not only that, you think of his words on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He prayed for them too. One of the, probably the most, another example that springs to mind is in Matthew 26. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. And Jesus replied, "Do what you came for, friend." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword and drew it out and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Here comes the equalizer, ready to do justice. "Put your sword back in its place," Jesus said to him, "for all who draw the sword will die by the sword." T. Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? It was right there. Justice was right there, but it was withheld. And Jesus allowed himself to be taken for us. And then just a couple of examples from history. And I will read, firstly, the one from Spurgeon, because he not only preached that, he lived it. So this was Spurgeon, an example of, simple example. I remember years ago, though, a certain person, a very good man, did not admire a course of action that I felt bound to take, and he was very angry, and called upon me to express his objections. And at last he said, "If you do that, I shall expose you in a pamphlet." Yes. Sounds very from the time period. I write a pamphlet and distribute it, and everyone will read what a bad man you are, and so forth. I like that. Expose you in a pamphlet. I was in a gracious mood at that time and was not to be ruffled in temper, nor yet turned from my course. I said to him quietly, "What do you think the pamphlet would cost?" "Oh," he said, "I don't know, but whatever it costs, I shall do it." I answered, "Well, if you feel you ought to do it, I should be sorry to see you go into debt, and therefore I will pay the printer's bill. I will trust you to give a truthful account of the matter, and I am not at all ashamed to have my course of action made as public as possible. Indeed, I'd rather it should be." He said he should not like to take any money from me. "Well," I replied, "perhaps you think there might be some profits from the sale. You should be quite welcome to them. Your own friends can print them for you. I will find the money, and you shall have the profit." I never heard any more of that pamphlet, and he is an exceedingly good friend of mine at the present moment, and will, I hope, always remain so. It's a simple little example, but it's a powerful thing. And I'll read the last one. I've got a whole bunch of examples, but I just picked two here. And this one is Corrie ten Boom, who, remember, was one of her family hid Jews in Holland, and she herself was eventually captured and taken to a prison camp. And then years later, she met in a church one of the men who had been her guard. "I was at a church service in Munich that I It was at a church service in Munich that I saw him, a former SS man who had stood guard at the shower room door in the processing center at Ravensbrück. He was the first of our actual jailers that I had seen since that time. And suddenly it was all there, the room full of mocking men, the heaps of clothing, Betsy's pain-blanched face," that's her sister. "He came up to me as the church was emptying, beaming and bowing. 'How grateful I am for your message, Fraulein,' he said, 'to think that, as you say, he has washed my sins away.' His hands was thrust out to shake mine, and I, who had preached so often to the people in Bloemendaal the need to forgive, kept my hand at my side. Even as the angry, vengeful thoughts boiled through me, I saw the sin of them. Jesus Christ had died for this man. Was I going to ask for more? Lord Jesus, I prayed, forgive me and help me to forgive him. I tried to smile. I struggled to raise my hand, and I could not. I felt nothing, not the slightest spark of warmth or charity. So again I breathed a silent prayer. Jesus, I prayed, I cannot forgive him. Give me your forgiveness. As I took his hand, the most incredible thing happened. From my shoulder along my arm and through my hand, a current seemed to pass from me to him, while into my heart sprang a love for this stranger that almost overwhelmed me. And so I discovered that it is not on our own forgiveness any more than on our own goodness that the world's healing hinges, but on his. When he tells us to love our enemies, he gives, along with the command, the love itself." And that's a very good thought to end on. We're not talking about drumming up goodness in ourselves. It's God's love, God's goodness, through the power of the Holy Spirit in our lives. And we will just stop there and Just to remember what we are saved for, and to encourage one another to live it, and to do not be overcome by evil, as we see the world in all its evilness. Overcome evil with good. So let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. I'm just going to ask the family to, or Jessica and Abby, to come up and close with a song here.